Welcome to Coco Club.
Coco Club is a radio program brought to you by Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. My name is Mrs. Sam. I'm the children's librarian at Hotchkiss Library. Each week, I'll bring you a short story, a poem, and a recipe to suggest pairing with your hot cocoa as you settle in to listen. This week, we did not post a recipe because we figured everyone would be busy making cookies for Santa. Also different this week, we're going to read the first half of the wonderful story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. Please go to facebook.com/Hotchkiss Library to find out what the recipe is for next week and to share your thoughts about the story with us. Thanks again for listening. The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. Henry Sugar was 41 years old and unmarried. He was also wealthy. He was wealthy because he had a rich father, who was now dead. He was unmarried because he was too selfish to share any of his money with a wife. He was 6 feet 2 inches tall, but he wasn't really as good-looking as he thought he was. He paid a great deal of attention to his clothes. He went to an expensive tailor for his suits, to a shirtmaker for his shirts, and to a bootmaker for his shoes. He used a costly aftershave on his face, and he kept his hands soft with a cream that contained turtle oil. His hairdresser trimmed his hair once every 10 days, and he always took a manicure at the same time. His upper front teeth had been capped at incredible expense, because the originals had been a rather nasty yellowish tinge. A small mole had been removed from his left cheek by a plastic surgeon. He drove a Ferrari car that must have cost him about the same as a country cottage. He lived in London in the summer, but as soon as the first frosts appeared in October, he was off to the West Indies or the south of France, where he stayed with friends. All his friends were wealthy from inherited money. Henry had never done a day's work in his life, and his personal motto, which he had invented himself, was this: "It is better to incur a mild rebuke than perform an onerous task." His friends thought this was hilarious. Men like Henry Sugar are to be found drifting like seaweed all over the world. They can be seen especially in London, New York, Paris, Nassau, Montego Bay, the Canes, and Saint Tropez. They are not particularly bad men, but they are not good men either. They are of no real importance. They are simply a part of the decoration. All of them, all wealthy people of this type, have one peculiarity in common. They have a terrific urge to make themselves still wealthier than they already are. The million is never enough, nor is the 2 million. Always they have this insatiable longing to get more money. And that is because they live in constant terror of waking up one morning and finding there's nothing in the bank. These people all employ the same methods for trying to increase their fortunes. They buy stocks and shares and watch them going up and down. They play roulette and blackjack for high stakes in casinos. They bet on horses. They bet on just about everything. Henry Sugar had once staked £1,000 on the result of a tortoise race on the Lord Liverpool's tennis lawn, and he had wagered double that sum with a man called Esmond Hanbury on an even sillier bet, which was as follows. They let Henry's dog out into the garden and watched it through the window. But before the dog was let out, each man had to guess beforehand what would be the first object that the dog would lift its leg against. Would it be a wall, a post, a bush, or a tree? Esmond chose a wall. Henry, who had been studying his dog's habits for days with a view to making this particular bet, chose a tree, and he won the money. With ridiculous games such as these, did Henry and his friends try to conquer the deadly boredom of being both idle and wealthy. Henry himself, as you may have noticed, was not above cheating a little on these friends, if he saw the chance. The bet with the dog was definitely not honest, nor, if you want to know, was the bet on the tortoise race. Henry cheated on that one by secretly forcing a little sleeping pill powder into the mouth of his opponent's tortoise an hour before the race. And now that you've got a rough idea of the sort of person Henry Sugar was, I can begin my story. One summer weekend, Henry drove down from London to Guildford to stay with Sir William Wyndham. The house was magnificent, and so were the grounds, but when Henry arrived on that Saturday afternoon, it was already pelting with rain. Tennis was out, croquet was out, so was swimming in Sir William's outdoor pool. The host and his guests sat glumly in the drawing room, staring at the rain splashing against the windows. The very rich are enormously resentful of bad weather. It is the one discomfort that their money cannot do anything about. Somebody in the room said, "Let's have a game of canasta for lovely high stakes." The others thought it was a splendid idea, but as there were five people in all, one would have to sit out. They cut the cards. Henry drew the lowest, the unlucky card. The other four sat down and began to play. Henry was annoyed at being out of the game. He wandered out of the drawing room into the great hall. He stared at the pictures for a few moments, then walked on through the house, bored to death and having nothing to do. Finally, he mooched into the library. Sir William's father had been a famous book collector, and all four walls of this huge room were lined with books from floor to ceiling. Henry Sugar was not impressed. He wasn't even interested. The only books he read were detective novels and thrillers. He ambled aimlessly around the room, looking to see if he could find any of the sort of books he liked. But the ones in Sir William's library were all leather-bound volumes with names on them, like Balzac, Ibsen, Voltaire, Johnson, and Pepys. Boring rubbish, the whole lot of it, Henry told himself. And he was just about to leave when his eye was caught and held by a book that was quite different from all the others. It was so slim, he would never have noticed it if it hadn't been sticking out a little from the ones on either side. And when he pulled it from the shelf, he saw that it was actually nothing more than a cardboard-covered exercise book of the kind children use at school. The cover was dark blue, but there was nothing written on it. Henry opened the exercise book. On the first page, hand-printed in ink, it said, "A report on an interview with Imhat Khan, the man who could see without his eyes, by John F. Cartwright, M.D., Bombay, India, December 1934. That sounds mildly interesting, Henry told himself. He turned over a page. What followed was all handwritten in black ink. The writing was clear and neat. Henry read the first two pages standing up. Suddenly he found himself wanting to read on. This was good stuff. It was fascinating. He carried the little book over to a leather armchair by the window and settled himself comfortably. Then he started reading again from the beginning. This is what Henry read in the little blue exercise book. "I, John Cartwright, am a surgeon at Bombay General Hospital. On the morning of the 2nd of December, 1934, I was in the doctor's restroom having a cup of tea. There were three other doctors there with me, all having a well-earned tea break. They were Dr. Marshall, Dr. Phillips, and Dr. McFarlane. There was a knock on the door. 'Come in,' I said. The door opened, and an Indian came in, who smiled at us and said, 'Excuse me, please, could I ask you gentlemen a favor?' The doctor's restroom was a most private place. Nobody other than a doctor was allowed to enter it, except in an emergency. 'This is a private room,' Dr. McFarlane said sharply. 'Yes, yes,' he answered. 'I know that I am very sorry to be bursting in like this, sirs, but I have a most interesting thing to show you.' All four of us were pretty annoyed, and we didn't say anything. 'Gentlemen,' he said, 'I am a man who can see without using his eyes.' We still didn't invite him to go on, but we didn't kick him out either. 'You can cover my eyes in any way you wish,' he said. 'You can bandage my head with 50 bandages, and I will still be able to read you a book.' He seemed perfectly serious. I felt my curiosity beginning to stir. 'Come here,' I said. He came over to me. 'Turn around.' He turned around. I placed my hands firmly over his eyes, holding the lids closed. 'Now,' I said, 'one of the other doctors in the room is going to hold up some fingers. Tell me how many he's holding up.' Dr. Marshall held up 7 fingers. 7, the Indian said. 'Once more,' I said. Dr. Marshall clenched both fists and hid all his fingers. 'No fingers,' the Indian said. I removed my hands from his eyes. 'Not bad,' I said. "Hold on," Dr. Marshall said. "Let's try this." There was a doctor's white coat hanging from a peg on the door. Dr. Marshall took it down and rolled it into a sort of long scarf, tight at the back. Then he wound it around the Indian's head and held the ends tight at the back. "Try him now," Dr. Marshall said. I took a key from my pocket. "What is this?" I asked. "A key," he answered. I put the key back and held up an empty hand. "What is this object?" I asked him. "There isn't any object," the Indian said. "Your hand is empty." Dr. Marshall removed the covering from the man's eyes. "How do you do it?" he asked. "What's the trick?" "There is no trick," the Indian said. "It's the genuine thing that I have managed after years of training." "What sort of training?" I asked. "Forgive me, sir," he said, "but that is a private matter." "Then why did you come here?" I asked. "I came to request a favor of you," he said. The Indian was a tall man of about 30, with light brown skin the color of a coconut. He had a small black mustache. Also, there was a curious matting of black hair growing all over the outsides of his ears. He wore a white cotton robe, and he had sandals on his bare feet. "You see, gentlemen," he went on, "I am at present earning my living by working in a traveling theater, and we have just arrived here in Bombay. Tonight we give our opening performance." "Where do you give it?" I asked. "In the Royal Palace Hall," he answered, "in Akia Street. I am the star performer. I am billed on the program as Imrat Khan, the man who can see without his eyes, and it is my duty to advertise the show in a big way. If we don't sell tickets, we don't eat." "What does this have to do with us?" I asked him. "Very interesting for you," he said. "Lots of fun. Let me explain. You see, whenever our theater arrives in a new town, I myself go straight to the largest hospital, and I ask the doctors there to bandage my eyes. I ask them to do it in the most expert fashion. They must make sure my eyes are completely covered many times over. It is important that this job is done by doctors, otherwise people will think I am cheating. Then, when I am fully bandaged, I go out into the street and I do a dangerous thing." "What do you mean by that?" I asked. "What I mean is I do something that is extremely dangerous for someone who cannot see." "What do you do?" I asked. "It is very interesting," he said, "and you will see me do it, if you will be so kind as to bandage me up first. It would be a great favor to me if you would do this little thing, sirs." I looked at the other three doctors. Dr. Phillips said he had to go back to his patients. Dr. McFarlane said the same. Dr. Marshall said, "Well, why not? It might be amusing. Won't take a minute." "I'm with you," I said, "but let's do the job properly. Let's make absolutely sure he can't peep." "You are extremely kind," the Indian said. "Please do whatever you wish." Dr. Phillips and Dr. McFarlane left the room. "Before we bandage him," I said to Dr. Marshall, "let's first of all seal down his eyelids. When we've done that, we'll fill his eye sockets with something soft and solid and sticky." "Such as what?" Dr. Marshall asked. "What about dough?" "Dough would be perfect," Dr. Marshall said. "Right," I said. "If you will nip down to the hospital bakery and get some dough, I'll take him to surgery and seal his lids." I led the Indian out of the restroom and down the long hospital corridor to the surgery. "Lie down here," I said, indicating the high bed. He lay down. I took a small bottle from the cupboard. It had an eyedropper in the top. "This is something called collodion," I told him. "It will harden over your closed eyelids so that it is impossible for you to open them." "How do I get it off afterward?" he asked me. "Alcohol will dissolve it away quite easily," I said. "It's perfectly harmless. Close your eyes now." The Indian closed his eyes. I applied collodion to both lids. "Keep them closed," I said. "Wait for it to harden." In a couple of minutes, the collodion had made a hard film over the eyelids, sticking them down tight. "Try to open them," I said. He tried, but he couldn't. Dr. Marshall came in with a basin of dough. It was ordinary white dough used for baking bread. It was nice and soft. I took a lump of the dough and plastered it over one of the Indian's eyes. I filled the whole socket and let the dough overlap into the surrounding skin. Then I pressed the edges down hard. I did the same with the other eye. "That isn't too uncomfortable, is it?" I asked. "No," the Indian said, "it's fine." "You do the bandaging," I said to Dr. Marshall. "My fingers are too sticky." A pleasure, Dr. Marshall said. Watch this. He took a thick wad of cotton wool and laid it atop of the Indian's dough-filled eyes. The cotton wool stuck down to the dough and stayed in place. Sit down, please, Dr. Marshall said. The Indian sat on the bed. Dr. Marshall took a roll of 3-inch bandage and proceeded to wrap it around and around the man's head. The bandage held the cotton wool and the dough firmly in place. Dr. Marshall pinned the bandage. After that, he took a second bandage and began to wrap that one not only around the man's eyes, but around his entire face and head. Please leave my nose free for breathing, the Indian said. Of course, Dr. Marshall answered. He finished the job and pinned down the edge of the bandage. How's that? He asked. Splendid, I said. There's no way he could possibly see through that. The whole of the Indian's head was now swathed in thick white bandage, and the only thing you could see was the end of his nose sticking out. He looked like a man who had had some terrible brain operation. How does that feel? Dr. Marshall asked him. It feels good, the Indian said. I must compliment you gentlemen on doing such a fine job. Off you go, then, Dr. Marshall said, grinning at me. Show us how clever you are at seeing things now. The Indian got off the bed and walked straight to the door. He opened it and went out. Great Scott, I said. Did you see that? He put his hand right on the doorknob. Dr. Marshall had stopped grinning. His face had suddenly gone white. I'm going to go after him, he said, rushing for the door. I rushed for the door as well. The Indian was walking quite normally along the hospital corridor. Dr. Marshall and I were about 5 yards behind him, and very spooky it was to watch this man with the enormous white and totally bandaged head strolling casually along the corridor just like anyone else. It was especially spooky when you knew for a certainty that his eyelids were sealed and his sockets filled with dough, and that there was a great wad of cotton wool and bandages on top of that. I saw a native orderly coming along the corridor toward the Indian. He was pushing a food trolley. Suddenly the orderly caught sight of the man with the white head, and he froze. The bandaged Indian stepped casually to one side of the trolley and went on. "He saw it," I cried. "He must have seen that trolley. He walked right around it. This is absolutely unbelievable." Dr. Marshall didn't answer me. His cheeks were white, his whole face rigid with shocked disbelief. The Indian came to the stairs and started to go down them. He went down with no trouble at all. He didn't even put a hand on the handrail. Several people were coming up the stairs. Each of them stopped, gasped, stared, and quickly got out of the way. At the bottom of the stairs, the Indian turned right and headed for the doors that led out into the street. Dr. Marshall and I kept close behind him. The entrance to our hospital stands back a little from the street, and there is a rather grand series of steps leading down from the entrance to a small courtyard with acacia trees around it. Dr. Marshall and I came out to the blazing sunshine and stood at the top of the steps. Below us in the courtyard, we saw a crowd of maybe 100 people. At least half of them were barefoot children, and as our white-headed Indian walked down the steps, they all cheered and shouted and surged toward him. He greeted them by holding both hands above his head. Suddenly, I saw the bicycle. It was over to one side at the bottom of the steps, and a small boy was holding it. The bicycle itself was quite ordinary, but on the back of it, fixed somehow to the rear wheel frame, was a huge placard, about 5 feet square. On the placard was written the following words. Imrat Khan, the man who sees without his eyes. Today my eyes have been bandaged by hospital doctors, appearing tonight and all this week at the Royal Palace Hall, Acadia Street, at 7 p.m. Don't miss it. You will see miracles performed. Our Indian had reached the bottom of the steps, and now he walked straight over to the bicycle. He said something to the boy, and the boy smiled. The Indian mounted the bicycle. The crowd made way for him. Then, lo and behold, this fellow with the blocked-up bandaged eyes now proceeded to ride across the courtyard and straight out into the bustling, honking traffic at the street beyond. The crowd cheered louder than ever. The barefoot children ran after him, squealing and laughing. For a minute or so, we were able to keep him in sight. We saw him riding superbly down the busy street, with cars whizzing past him and a bunch of children running in his wake. Then he turned a corner and was gone. "I feel quite giddy," Dr. Marshall said. "I can't bring myself to believe it." "We have to believe it," I said. "He couldn't possibly have removed the dough from under the bandages. We never let him out of our sight. and as for unsealing his eyelids, that job would take him 5 minutes with cotton wool and alcohol. Do you know what I think? Dr. Marshall said. I think we have witnessed a miracle. We turned and walked slowly back into the hospital. For the rest of the day, I kept busy with patients in the hospital. At 6 in the evening, I came off duty and drove back to my flat for a shower and a change of clothes. It was the hottest time of year in Bombay, and even after sundown, the heat was like an open furnace. If you sat still in a chair and did nothing, the sweat would come seeping out of your skin. Your face glistened with dampness all day long, and your shirt stuck to your chest. I took a long, cool shower. I drank a whiskey and a soda sitting on the veranda, with only a towel around my waist. Then I put on some clean clothes. At 7:10, I was outside the Royal Palace Hall in Arcadia Street. It was not much of a place. It was one of those smallish, seedy halls that can be hired inexpensively for meetings or dances. There was a fair-sized crowd of local Indians milling around outside the ticket office, and a large poster over the entrance proclaimed that the International Theatre Company was performing every night that week. It said that there would be jugglers and conjurers, acrobats and sword swallowers, and fire eaters and snake charmers, and a one-act play entitled The Raja and the Tiger Lady. But above all this, and in by far the largest letters, it said Imrat Khan, the miracle man who sees without his eyes. I bought a ticket and went in. The show lasted 2 hours. To my surprise, I thoroughly enjoyed it. All of the performers were excellent. I liked the man who juggled with cooking utensils. He had a saucepan, a frying pan, a baking tray, a huge plate, and a casserole pot all flying through the air at the same time. The snake charmer had a big green snake that stood almost on the tip of its tail and swayed to the music of his flute. The fire eater ate fire, and the sword swallower pushed a thin pointed rapier at least 4 feet down his throat and into his stomach. Last of all, to a great fanfare of trumpets, our friend Imrat Khan came on to do his act. The bandages we had put on him at the hospital had now been removed. Members of the audience were called onto the stage to blindfold him with sheets and scarves and turbans, and in the end there was so much material wrapped around his head he could hardly keep his balance. He was then given a revolver. A small boy came out and stood at the left of the stage. I recognized him as the one who had held the bicycle outside the hospital that morning. The boy placed a thin tin can on top of his head and stood quite still. The audience became deathly silent as Imrat Khan took aim. He fired. The bang made us all jump. The tin can flew off the boy's head and clattered onto the floor. The boy picked it up and showed the bullet hole to the audience. Everyone clapped and cheered. The boy smiled. Then the boy stood against a wooden screen, and Imrat Khan threw knives all around his body, most of them going very close indeed. This was a splendid act. Not many people could have thrown knives with such accuracy, even with their eyes uncovered. But there he was, this extraordinary fellow, with his head so swathed in sheets it looked like a great snowball on a stick, and he was flicking the sharp knives into the screen within a hair's breadth of the boy's head. The boy smiled all the way through the act, and when it was over the audience stamped its feet and screamed with excitement. Imrat Khan's last act, though not so spectacular, was even more impressive. A metal barrel was brought on stage. The audience was invited to examine it, to make sure there were no holes. There were no holes. The barrel was then placed over Imrat Khan's already bandaged head. It came down over his shoulders and as far as his elbows, pinning the upper part of his arms to his sides. But he could still hold out his forearms and his hands. Someone put a needle in one of his hands and a length of cotton thread into the other. With no false moves, he neatly threaded the cotton through the eye of the needle. I was flabbergasted. As soon as the show was over, I made my way backstage. I found Imrat Khan in a small but clean dressing room, sitting quietly on a wooden stool. The little Indian boy was unwinding the mass of scarves and sheets from around his head. "Ah," he said, "it is my friend the doctor from the hospital. Come in, sir, come in." "I saw the show," I said. "And what did you think?" "I liked it very much. I thought you were wonderful." "Thank you," he said. "That is a high compliment." "I must congratulate your assistant as well," I said, nodding to the small boy. "He is very brave." "He cannot speak English," the Indian said, "but I will tell him what you said." He spoke rapidly to the boy in Hindustani, and the boy nodded solemnly but said nothing. "Look," I said, I did you a small favor this morning. Would you do me one in return? Would you consent to come out and have supper with me?" All the wrappings were off his head now. He smiled at me and said, "I think you are feeling curious, doctor. Am I right?" "Very curious," I said. "I'd like to talk to you." Once again, I was struck by the peculiarly thick matting of hair growing out the outside of his ears. I had not seen anything quite like it on another person. "I have never been questioned by a doctor before," he said, "but I have no objection. It would be a pleasure to have supper with you. Shall I wait in the car?" "Yes, please," he said. "I must wash myself and get out of these dirty clothes." I told him what my car looked like, and I said I'd be waiting outside. He emerged 15 minutes later, wearing a clean white cotton robe and the usual sandals on his bare feet. And as soon as the two of us were sitting comfortably in a small restaurant that I sometimes went to because it made the best curry in the city, I drank my beer with my curry. Imrat Khan drank lemonade. "I am not a writer," I said to him. "I am a doctor. But if you will tell me your story from the beginning, if you will explain to me how you developed this magical power of being able to see without your eyes, I will write it down as faithfully as I can, and then perhaps I can get it published in the British Medical Journal or even in some famous magazine. And because I am a doctor and not just some writer trying to sell a story for money, people will be far more inclined to take seriously what I say. It would help you, wouldn't it, to become better known?" "It would help me very much," he said. "But why would you want to do this?" "Because I'm madly curious," I answered. "That is the only reason." Imrat Khan took a mouthful of curried rice and chewed it slowly. Then he said, "Very well, my friend, I will do it." "Splendid," I cried. "Let's go back to my flat as soon as we've finished eating, and then we can talk without anyone disturbing us." We finished our meal. I paid the bill. Then I drove Imrat Khan back to my flat. So that's as far as we're going to read today. Tune in next week to find out what happens and to hear Imrat Khan's story. Thank you for listening to Coco Club. Again, participate in the discussion on facebook.com/HotchkissLibrary. All sounds in this recording are from freesound.org. Coco Club is brought to you by Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. My name is Miss Sam. Happy holidays.